this week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
Since we met you people 500 years ago, look at us. We've given everything. You are still taking. And in return for all of this, what have we got? Nothing.
Dr. Ama Atu Aido, preeminent Ghanaian author, playwright, poet, and feminist, has transitioned at 81.
The traditional story is that on June 19th, 1865, General Granger and the men in blue show up in Galveston, Texas, a major slave port, in order to apprise the enslaved Africans, who we are told were not aware of the Emancipation Proclamation, that they were free. Now, there's so much wrong with that traditional story.
Dr. Gerald Horn on the untold history of Juneteenth.
The fight for freedom and emancipation for African Americans is inextricably linked to the emancipation of the entire working class.
Longshore workers are closing all ports in Northern California on Juneteenth. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt. In January of 1863, enslaved Africans in 10 Confederate states were freed by Abraham Lincoln's issuance of the Emancipation Proclamation. However, the Union lacked the military capacity to enforce the order in Texas. It required 2 years to execute, thus marking the end of chattel slavery in those states in rebellion against the Union. Celebrations ensued across Texas and subsequently other states. The proclamation issued on Galveston Island did not free enslaved Africans in the border states or other states of the Union. It was not until the passage of the 13th Amendment in December of 1865 that chattel slavery was rendered unconstitutional and illegal in every part of the United States. All three of these historical events must be understood as a political continuum: the Emancipation, the General Order on Galveston Island, the 13th Amendment, with each contributing to the dismantling and ending of legalized slavery in the U.S. That was Bobby McFerrin, The Elephant's Child. This is the second year of a newly created Juneteenth federal holiday in the U.S. to commemorate an important moment in the overall battle to end chattel slavery in the South. It was on this day in 1865 that Texas, the last western boundary of the Confederacy, was informed by General Gordon Granger and thousands of armed black troops that General Order No. 3 henceforth declared that the remaining enslaved Africans in Texas, the estimation 250,000, were hereby freed from the brutal and inhumane institution of slavery. General Order No. 3 also promised to enslaved Africans absolute equality of personal rights and rights of property between former slave owners and their captives. And it clarified the relations between slaveholders and enslaved as one between employer and hired labor. Although President Biden signed a bill in 2022 declaring Juneteenth an official holiday, many African-American scholars and activists have warned that the celebration of Juneteenth is not the same as freedom or liberation. Scholar-activist Dr. Gerald Horn, author of The Counter-Revolution of 1836, Texas Slavery and Jim Crow, and The Roots of American Fascism, published in 2022, is here to shed light on the untold history of Juneteenth.
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me. And second of all, let me cut to the chase and bring our audience up to speed about my revelations concerning Juneteenth. The traditional story is that on June 19th, 1865, General Granger and the men in blue show up in Galveston, Texas, a major slave port, in order to apprise the enslaved Africans, who we are told were not aware of the Emancipation Proclamation, that they were free. Now, there's so much wrong with that traditional story. Number one, the Emancipation Proclamation of the Lincoln regime on January 1st, 1863, did not extend, obviously, to Texas or to other parts of the slave South that were precisely in rebellion against the Lincoln government. It would be as if the United States government passed a law that said that the remnants of slavery in Mauritania and Northwest Africa would no longer obtain. Well, the U.S. government has no jurisdiction in Mauritania, and it would be null and void. They would have to send an army there to enforce that diktat. And precisely that was what was happening on June 19th, 1865. In other words, General Granger and his forces were showing up to impose a new order, more so than telling people they were free who apparently did not know they were free. Now, for some reason, that traditional narrative plays into an antiquated idea that Black people were somehow aware of the events that were swirling around them. And certainly, subsequent research, including my own research, has suggested that the Africans in Galveston well knew about the Emancipation Proclamation, but they also knew that it did not obtain in Galveston. Just like, as I will detail momentarily and detail at some length in my book, after June 19, 1865, it's not as if slavery disappeared from the landscape in Texas. Just because you have a law, even with guns to back it up, that does not necessarily mean that there will be some transgressors who try to violate that law. I mean, for example, I've been made to understand that it is illegal to use cocaine. So should we infer from that that cocaine is not used in Texas, for example? Yeah, it's obviously ludicrous. So here's the story with regard to Juneteenth. There is a Juneteenth that we should pay attention to that in many ways carries more lessons than the traditional Juneteenth of June 19th, 1865. And that is the June 19th of 1867. What I mean by that is that, as many of your listeners know, during the U.S. Civil War, 1861 to 1865, in an opportunistic fashion, France had seized Mexico. That leads to the Mexican-American holiday of Cinco de Mayo, which represents, in Marx, an uprising against French rule in Mexico. By June 19th, 1865, Texas, the slave state which was least damaged by the U.S. Civil War, was banking upon the French occupation of Mexico to continue the revolt against Washington in order to perpetuate the enslavement of Africans. In the event that that diabolical plan was not able to be launched, the idea was that the enslavers of Texas would move en masse, oftentimes with their African so-called property in tow, so that the enslavement process could continue south of the border. But what happens is that there is mass resentment and revolt against the French in Mexico, as suggested by Cinco de Mayo. It's reaching a crest post-1865. And in fact, what happens is that by 1867, yes, June 19th, 1867, you have the French puppet leader, Maximilian, who is executed by the Mexican progressive forces under Benito Juarez, you should also know that the Mexican progressive forces were in a de facto alliance with black soldiers in blue, that is to say, black soldiers under the aegis of the United States government, who had the French occupiers in a kind of pincers movement, which leads directly to the capture and execution of Maximilian on, as noted, June 19th, 1867. And I think that that second Juneteenth is worthy of marking and worthy of celebration. Number one, it brings the process of enslavement of Africans closer to an end than June 19th, 1865. Second of all, there is an important lesson there with regard to trans-border cooperation between and amongst peoples of African descent, namely the enslaved in places like Galveston and the soldiers in blue that were aforementioned of Ebony Hue, and their cooperation with progressive Mexicans, because that leads to a conclusion, a positive conclusion, and a positive prospect for the future. So I think it's important to salute that second Juneteenth.
Dr. Gerald Horn holds the Morris Professorship of History and African American Studies. His research has addressed issues of racism in a variety of relations involving labor, politics, civil rights, international relations, and war. He's the author of many books, including The Counter-Revolution of 1836, Texas, Slavery, and Jim Crow, and The Roots of American Fascism, published in 2022.
When will we be paid for the work we've done? When will we be paid for the work we've done? Fought in your wars in every land to keep this country free, y'all, for women, children, and men. But any time we ask for pay or loan, that's when everything seems to turn out wrong.
That was Prince, When Will We Be Paid? This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akul Holt. International Longshore and Warehouse Union Local 10 workers are closing all ports in Northern California on Juneteenth. The local is making actor and activist Danny Glover an honorary member. Glover participated in the 1968 San Francisco State University strike that was successful in winning the first ethnic studies program in the United States. At that time, the ILWU Local 10 supported the strike by providing jobs for Danny and other strikers. Clarence Thomas, ILWU Local 10 retired secretary treasurer, talked about Juneteenth and the class struggle aspect of the fight against slavery with Pacifica Steve Seltzer.
Just as a personal note, the first time I ever heard the term Juneteenth was from my mother when I was growing up. And that is because she was born in Port Arthur, Texas. And whenever there was a 4th of July celebration, she always reminded us, me and my siblings, that Black people didn't celebrate the 4th of July, that they celebrated Juneteenth. And that was my first introduction to understanding the concept. But for those in a listening audience who don't have any idea, Juneteenth commemorates June 19th, 1865, the date of the last enslaved Black people in the United States, which was Texas, that were formally informed and emancipated. It was also a reminder that the job of ending all form of slavery is not yet finished. And so Karl Marx once wrote, "We have nothing to lose but our chains and a world to win." The U.S., like all of the Americas, was built on the backs of enslaved labor. And on Juneteenth, we celebrate the emancipation of the last of the enslaved Black people in the United States, as well as a reminder in our commitment to fight against the legacy of slavery. In other words, we must fight against the longstanding impact of systemic racism, white supremacy, racialized capitalism, and all forms of discrimination, which is used to keep the working class divided. You know, as we're talking about Marx, I think it's important to bring him up because of the fact that he understood the dynamics of race and class. And I think that it's important for people to understand, especially, you know, workers, both Black and white workers, why should labor be celebrating this? And so Marx wrote extensively about the Civil War and slavery in the United States, and he made it abundantly clear that enslaved Black people in North America had to be free before wage slaves of the working class could be free of exploitation. When we talk about the term wage slave, what he's referring to is the fact that working people have to sell their labor 8, 10, 12, 16 orders a day in order to survive. And I tell people, you know, longshore workers and other workers, we can be described as that. The only exception that I would make with regards to longshore workers is that we make living wages overall. Not to say that we are getting the wages that we deserve, but most certainly when you compare the wages that we make to other workers who don't receive living wages, it's important to mention in this country that you have very few households, man, that have $200,000 a year. Very few, probably 18% or less. And I could be overstating that. It could be 10%. And if you live in San Francisco, Steve, you know what the cost of rents and the cost of living in San Francisco. It's exorbitant. So when we talk about a wage slave, we're basically talking about how the workers have to sell their labor to the bosses. And so there's a connection between a wage slave and African Americans who were in bondage, chattel slavery. And so that was a threat to the entire working class. And we can see with the end of the Civil War, this freed up labor to begin to organize, because we have to realize that somewhat 21 years after the Emancipation Proclamation is when we see the Haymarket and the emergence of the working class to organize unions all across the country. So the Civil War was part of the class struggle, because on the one hand, you had enslaved Africans working without pay. So the workers in the North are competing against workers who don't even make a living. You understand? So that put tremendous pressure. So the country, capitalism, could not survive in the United States with that kind of contradiction. It could not survive. And that is the reason why there was a civil war. And I think that one of the things that's important for your listening audience to realize is that African Americans played a very important role in fighting for their freedom. We don't hear enough about that. And what I'm speaking about specifically, Steve, is the fact that there were some 250 slave uprisings that had occurred before the Civil War. So this is just some of the information that I think is important for people to understand. But in terms of the ILWU's contribution, in terms of commemorating Juneteenth, it was in 2020, we had some 20,000 people that had come out to the Port of Oakland to hear people like Angela Davis, Danny Glover, Boots Riley, and rank and filers and many, many others, community leaders and activists. That was organized in response to the George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and all of the various murders that were taking place by police departments all across the country. But it was also an opportunity to highlight some of these specific struggles that were going on in the Bay Area that had national ramifications. And I'm speaking specifically about the matter concerning the attempt to privatize the third busiest port on the West Coast, the Port of Oakland, by a man by the name of John Fisher, who owns the Oakland A's. And I think it was important to highlight that particular struggle, because when we talk about Juneteenth, we need to be able to connect the dots to today to make it relevant, because it's the same struggle that's going on. It's the ruling class against the working class. And at this particular time in American history, where there is so much being done to erase the true history of the United States of America, to create division, to turn the working class against itself, specifically around the issue of race, gender, it's important that programs like this can be made available to set the record straight and to raise the social consciousness of the working class. But one of the things that Local 10 was able to do was initiate a movement where the entire ILWU Longshore Division made a decision not to work on Juneteenth in 2020. And that meant that all 29 ports on the West Coast were shut down, including Vancouver, Canada. And so that was the precursor for the feds to make Juneteenth a federal holiday. And I think that just goes to show you the power of the working class. Anytime that workers, specifically longshore workers, who have such an impact at the point of production, when they withhold their labor for 8 hours, that impacts trucking schedules, train schedules. The employer has to rearrange all of their, because of what they call just-in-time delivery. And it disrupts things. So the fact that the employer agrees with the union for these shutdowns, because if they didn't do it, that means that their schedules are all screwed up. So they have to go out and tell their customers, hey, we're not going to be moving any cargo for 8 hours today because of Juneteenth. So I know that this year, specifically, Local 10, the largest local in Northern California, we are involved with moving cargo at 5 Bay Area ports. I know that in Seattle, Tacoma, they will not be moving any cargo for 8 hours in the Pacific Northwest. And I'm glad to see that we're now able to show the working class, and particularly our white sisters and brothers, in terms of understanding how the fight for freedom and emancipation for African Americans is inextricably linked to the emancipation of the entire working class.
That was ILWU Local 10 retired Secretary Treasurer Clarence Thomas speaking to Pacifica Steve Zeltzer.
Scholars and scientists now concede that Africa is the birthplace of mankind. Africans were the first builders of civilization. They discovered mathematics, invented writing, developed sciences, engineering, medicine, religion, fine arts, and built the Great Pyramids. An architectural achievement which still baffles modern science.
The 225th emperor, direct descent from Solomon and the Queen of Sheba. He is the King of Kings, the Lion of Judah. The name Haile Selassie means power of the Trinity.
Educate yourselves of Africa. Liberate yourself, Africa. Keep your heads up high. No more will we cry. Hey.
history that they stole. Africa is written in our souls. Africa, oldest nation on this earth. Know just what you're worth. Well, well, ships that sail to distant places robbed us of our rights and words. History says that you've betrayed us, talking of the gods you serve. Hear the rumbling in the sky, tears that our forefathers cry. And today we're still in chains, take the shackle from our minds. You're the cornerstone, the king upon the throne.
Stephen Marley, Made in Africa. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I am Akua Holt. Happy Juneteenth. The late Marion E. Barnes was a storyteller, author, historian, child advocate, and community leader in Austin, Texas. Her story is based on historical records, a story nobody would publish because it depicts inhumanity and violent practices plantation owners use to violate and abuse the rights of African captives. Throughout what Barnes terms 300 years of Holocaust, here is Marion Barnes talking about her story.
Wade and Water is based on the lives of people who once lived. I learned their stories by talking with formerly enslaved persons during my childhood and with elderly members of my family, and by consulting the library records of the United States government-sponsored interviews with formerly enslaved people conducted by writers in the 1930s. Perhaps because Wade in the Water is not a pretty story, its path to the public has been obstructed. Although written originally for Talk That Talk, an anthology of African-American storytelling, it was rejected by the publisher's editor. Subsequently taped to be broadcast during Black Heritage Month, the producer of the program for which it was intended refused to air the story. She said it made slavery seem too cruel. When a series of attempts to find a publisher failed, I decided to include Wade in the Water in a self-published anthology. Surprisingly, respected reviewers advised that it be excluded rather than risk alienating readers. What underlies the resistance to presenting Wade in the Water? To say it makes slavery seem too cruel is not plausible, since the story does not portray slavery to be nearly so cruel as it actually was. And readers should not be alienated by a depiction of life in the era of the American slavocracy unless the depiction conflicts with information, ideas, and ideals with which the reader is comfortable. I believe that to be the case, having encountered Americans of every hue who accept the highly sanitized version of the American slavocracy that is generally put forth. That is, the institution of slavery, though misguided, evolved during that era because of the country's developmental needs and the cultureless state of captured Africans. Also, captives received civilizing benefits from exposure to Western culture that outweighed the loss of freedom and abuse of human rights. Believers of this myth are disturbed when it's pointed out that captured Africans came from a part of Africa where a successful smallpox vaccine was being used. Not until 1796 would Dr. Edward Jenner become the first Western physician to develop a similar vaccine. They are further disquieted by evidence that ancestors of the captives possessed knowledge and technological skills in astronomy exceeding that of 20th century Western scientists, and by evidence that much of the progress of modern civilization rests upon the inventions, discoveries, and spiritual leadership of the captives and their descendants. Such people are equally distressed facing the reality of slavery in America, for which there is no historical parallel. Never before nor since has the enslavement of a people included the systematic destruction of their history, culture, languages, communities, families and personal self-esteem as implemented by Americans. The bestiality of members of the master class is also without precedent. In the instruments and forms of torture devised, in enslaving their own children, in multiple incestuous unions with their children and grandchildren, whom they customarily enslaved or sold, in the attempt to legally dehumanize the enslaved population, in barbaric lynchings that were still occurring almost daily long after freedom had been proclaimed. Newspapers advertised lynchings in advance. Crowds came from afar on chartered trains. Victims were roasted over slow fires and their bodies mutilated. In addition, bodies were often cannibalized. People hoarded body parts as souvenirs, and photographs of lynched, mutilated bodies were sold as picture postcards. Well beyond the 1920s, lynchings were still being tallied. Yearly totals were publicized along with the gross national product and other national records. We need to remember the death-dealing afterglow of the Holocaust in which we now live continues to claim lives daily, directly and indirectly. We need to remember.
That was the late Marion Barnes, storyteller, educator, and author of Talk That Talk. Thanks to Frieda Worden, series producer of WINGS, Women's International News Gathering Service. Nana Camille Yarborough, Tell It. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Freed men and women purchased land or emancipation grounds for Juneteenth gatherings throughout Texas. Emancipation Park in Houston, Texas, was purchased in 1872 to commemorate the end of captivity and to create cooperative economics. Richard Allen, Richard Brock, Reverend Jack Yates, and Elias Dibble paid $800 for 10 acres of parkland. The men led by Yates were members of the historic Antioch Missionary Baptist Church and the Trinity Methodist Episcopal Church. Emancipation Park is the oldest park in Houston and the oldest park in Texas. During the Jim Crow era, it was the only African-American public park in the entire city of Houston. Esteemed elder and community leader, Mr. Eugene Floyd, shares his early memories of Juneteenth in Houston, Texas.
I'm Eugene Floyd, past president of Lone Star Golf Association, retired postal employee, a federal employee, and I have a past president of Lone Star Golf Association, also past exalted ruler of the IBPOE of W, that's the Elks, mm-hmm. Improved Benevolent Protective Order of Elks of the World.
How important is Juneteenth nowadays? And some of the history of Juneteenth in the Houston area.
During my generation, we had no history. Juneteenth was a day of celebration from, you know, all we knew. Let me not say we, all I knew, because we didn't get a lot of classroom bookwork teaching of it because we were somewhat suppressed in our teachings. A great many of us, it was a day of fun, and it was all, like, proclaimed as a day of red soda water and barbecue.
Where did the red soda water come from?
Strawberry soda water, and it was almost like a stigma that black folks like strawberry soda water and Wallametta.
And when did it become the movement come to make it a holiday?
That was just, as far as I can remember, a few days ago. Talked with his brother just a couple of weeks ago. He was a state legislator. What was his name?
Al Edwards.
That's when it really became, you know, a focal point, you know, prior to, before the political action, black people, you know, became politicized back in the day. We didn't have any spokesmen who were really out front. A great many of our, I'd say, supposed leaders, they were just figurehead that lived good. And even the remark of, I got mine, you got to get yours. They wouldn't help nobody do anything. But the 19th of June was a day of celebration and fun. Even back then, that was a place out on South Main somewhere. I never went to it. It was called Playland Park. It was, you know, a theme park, you know, rides and all that kind of stuff. Sometimes we were referred to as Negroes, sometimes as coloreds. They let the coloreds and the Negroes go out there on the 19th of June. That was the only day we could go to Playland Park and play. It was a theme park, something like Disneyland. But the rest of the time, it was just normal activities with me. I don't know about other people, but Juneteenth was a day of fun. Like I said, watermelon, barbecue, and good times, and maybe a trip down to Galveston if your family had a car. When Edwards brought it about, then they started having the Juneteenth. That really, you know, it really became like a holiday, you know, looking forward to it, and a day off. I do believe it's a national holiday now, is it not?
Yes.
Okay. Well, you know, back then it wasn't. Go ahead. I'm listening.
No, I'm saying one thing that was in peril is how the day became about anyway, because it came about because black people in Texas were so late to find out about being emancipated.
Well, history tells us, you know, remember back then they didn't have the internet.
Yeah.
During that time, the war between the North and the South, the states ended. Remember, everything was slow, and the news didn't get down here until later, after it was all over. There were a great many white people who knew about the Emancipation Proclamation, primarily the end of slavery. They knew about it, but they didn't tell the slaves down here in Texas or Louisiana because, hell, they were still working us to death for nothing. So when word got here, it was a joyous day, and it's, you know, the rest of it's just history. During my day, again, you know, the 19th of June was not a holiday. It was just a day of good fun and what have you. For me, I grew up not around but on Dowling Street. My grandmother's address was just north of the Emancipation Park. That's where I grew up, and all my childhood was spent, you know, playing in the park. And it was a real park at that time during my day. We had all kind of seesaws, sliding boards, games. The gym was open. It had a regular, you know, basketball court, gym on the inside, a tennis court on the backside, a swimming pool that was a swimming pool and not just a wading pool. I don't know how our leaders, our supposed leaders, allowed them to grew up that swimming pool thing and make that park something other than a park. It's not a swimming pool anymore. It's just a wading pool. I worked at the swimming pool in the mid-40s, and it was a focal point. Everybody came to the park to watch the guy. They had a fence around it, and people would stand around at night during the day and watch people swim in the park back there. That was a softball diamond at teams. I can remember the club matinee had great softball teams. The Hillshire Home Supply Company, great softball teams. The Senate Grill, at night, to turn on the lights and watch softball out there. It was a great time. And I can remember going out there from time to time on Juneteenth, and people will be, you know, picnicking and sharing. It was great. Now I can't say when it stopped, because I went into the military in 1954, mm-hmm. and I spent 3 years. And when I came back, I got a job, and I didn't hang out anymore. I went to work, came home, and I went to barber school, cut hair in the evenings, and carried mail in the day. I didn't do a lot of socializing, but we always look forward to Juneteenth.
You were also part of the golf community here. Time it was looked upon as being segregated. Black people couldn't do anything to play, but they could catch. How did that all change about over the years?
It changed about because people attitudes, and mostly through legislation. The golf courses were integrated in Houston in 1954. It was brought on by a group of black guys that wanted to play golf. A lead spokesperson was Dr. Beal, B-E-A-L-L, I think was the name. He's a very prominent black doctor here in Houston. I'm sure you got one of those smartphones to tell you everything. When we finished talking, you look up Beal versus Holcomb. Look up that case, Beal versus Holcomb, and it'll tell you all about the struggle for Negroes to play golf here in Houston. Dr. Beal was our spokesperson, and Holcomb was the mayor of Houston. That's what the court case was referred to as, Beal versus Holcomb.
That was esteemed elder Mr. Eugene Floyd, a veteran, retired postal employee, an Elk, and former president of the Lone Star Golf Association, sharing his personal memories of Juneteenth. In 1980, Texas House Bill 1016 was created by the late state representative Al Edwards and passed in the 66th legislature, declaring June 19th, Emancipation Day in Texas, a legal holiday. Thanks to Mr. Floyd and to KPFT's Rad Rich, host of the People's News, for producing this segment. Even in today's era, 158 years since the first Juneteenth, African Americans live a fragile, marginal existence by every socioeconomic indicator and have been playing catch-up since the 1870s. Thus, Juneteenth should be understood in a proper historical context because it was one of the three mighty blows that ended chattel slavery. It should be recognized and appreciated, but it should not be mistakenly celebrated as the liberation of black people from racial oppression, domination, or exploitation. Dr. M. Tangalizi Senyika. Ghanaian author, poet, playwright, feminist, and scholar, Dr. Ama Atu Aida was born in a small village in Ghana's central Fonti-speaking region on March 23, 1942. Her father was a strong influence and opened the first school in their village. At the age of 15, she decided she wanted to be a writer, and within a few years had achieved that goal after entering a competition. Aida was Secretary for Education in Ghana from 1982 to 83 under President Jerry Rawlings' administration. Her work, The Dilemma of a Ghost, was published in 1965, making Aida the first published African female dramatist. As a novelist, she won the Commonwealth Writers' Prize in 1992 with the novel Changes. In 2000, she established the Mombasa Foundation in Accra to promote and support the work of African women writers. Here's Dr. Ama Atu Aido in 1987 speaking to a journalist about the devastating impact of colonization, slavery, and exploitation of African raw materials and its people for over 500 years.
Since we met you people 500 years ago, look at us. We've given everything. You are still taking. It's true. I mean, where would the whole Western world be without Africa? Our cocoa, our timber, our gold, our diamonds, our platinum, our whatever, everything you are is us. I am not saying it, it's a fact. And in return for all of this, what have we got? Nothing. Anti-personnel indoctrination against ourselves. If you go and cook your horrible diseases like AIDS, you say it is us. You brought us tuberculosis. We didn't have this big cough until white people came here. In exchange for Africa giving Europe 500 solid years of our people, I mean, not Europe, the Western world, of our human beings to work your canes, to dig your gold, to take in gold itself, diamond, I mean, you know, fish, peanuts, palm oil, everything. In exchange for that, we have got nothing. Nothing. And you know it. Nothing. And you look upon, you know, white folks look upon us like monkeys. It is true. It's in your literature. Hey, you know, some of your best thinkers have said this about us. Have you heard of the, I mean, all these Germans? Have you heard?
Okay.
Yes. They said Lord Burton, yes. People like that. They said we don't even have the brain of animals. That's what we've got from you people.
But don't you think that this is over now?
Over where? Is it over? Who said that AIDS came from the green monkey? Is it over? Is it over?
Well, if this is your impression, do you think that you can ever forgive us?
It's not a question of forgiveness. I have nothing against you. My point is that you did and you are doing for your survival what is necessary. The fact that we didn't do enough for our own survival and we are still not doing enough for our survival, that is not your problem. You know, even everybody that God has created has a sense of survival. You know, and until if we don't develop it, we can't blame white people. You came here because you needed these things. You took gunpowder from the Chinese. You needed them to shoot people. I think that for me and members of my family, Elmina Castle has got a very, very special significance because they tortured my father's father, my real grandfather, to death there by the colonial government. So for me, I mean, when people like me talk about colonization, neo-colonization, it's not just because one is being intellectually smart. You know, I mean, we have personal touches with it. I mean, I cannot forget that this happened to my grandfather.
Do you consider AIDS as a new form of colonization?
Of course.
Why?
That's why, you know, my people, the Akans, we have a proverb. It says that good morning, thank you, is never enough to salt anybody's food forever. You cannot build your life on thank you, thank you, thank you, morning, thank you, English, thank you, God, you know, which is what aid makes, you know, we are always receiving, receiving, receiving. Nobody, look, and I don't care who hears, nobody anywhere in this world is going to send you their best of anything. Do you see? Neither the experts nor the, what I mean, people, you give us what you can afford. Aid is the leftover, really, and it cannot be enough. What I mean, aid, you can, when you know the world is now, the world is one place, so there is nothing wrong if my house is in a crisis and you offered me something. There's nothing wrong, you know, because there is interrelationship. But a whole nation, a whole continent, cannot live forever on aid. And I think aid is, we are in Africa, we are in danger of making foreign aid a kind of policy that is wrong. I think that it humiliates our people. The people in the villages have not asked anybody to go around begging on their behalf. Well, and being a writer, really, it is crazy. I mean, it is a very self-consuming kind of activity. You know, you sit in a room, you write, and you think that other people outside want to hear it. I mean, the tensions of, you know, writing a book, it's tense. When you finish writing the book, you are tense because you wonder, how will the publishers and editors react to a book, to a story? Even when it's published, you wonder, why are they saying that my books are selling in Ghana, in Nigeria, in Sierra Leone, Botswana, Lesotho, even South Africa, Kenya, and I'm still so poor? So all of these issues are part of the horror, real horror, of being a woman, a writer, an African. But you don't stop writing because of any of them. You just go on. Life is like that.
That was renowned Ghanaian author, playwright, poet, and feminist, Dr. Ama Atu Aido, who transitioned at 81 on May 31st, 2023. Her work, including plays like Anoa, have been read in schools across West Africa, along with works of other greats like Wole Soyinka and Chinua Achebe. Aido held a fellowship in creative writing at Stanford University before returning to Ghana in 1969 to teach English at the University of Ghana. She served as a research fellow at the Institute of African Studies there and as a lecturer in English at the University of Cape Coast. Aido was also a longtime visiting professor of Africana Studies and Literary Arts at Brown University.
To things than to these. 'Tis the ancestor's birth when the fire's voice is heard. 'Tis the ancestor's birth in the voice of the waters. Those who have died have never left. The dead are not under the earth. They are in the rustling trees. They are in the groaning woods. They are in the crying grass. They are in the moaning rocks. The dead are not under the earth. So listen more often to things than to beings. Listen more often to things than to beings. 'Tis the ancestor's breath.
Sweet honey in the rock, breaths. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by Akua Holt and the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective. Special thanks to Dr. M. Dangalizi Sanyika for his contribution to today's show. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening. Before we go, I leave you with this quote. It is certain in any case that ignorance allied with power is the most ferocious enemy justice can have. James Baldwin, from his essay, No Name in the Street.